This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The death of former President Ronald Reagan dominated the news over the weekend, and today, remembrances, memorials, and preparations continue in Dixon, Illinois, where the future president grew up, at the site of his presidential library in Simi Valley, California, where a hearse carrying his body has just arrived, here in Washington, where a state funeral is scheduled for this Friday, and in many other places around the country and the world. Tomorrow, we'll devote this program to a look back at President Reagan and to the revolutions and crises of the 1980s. Today, though, the challenges of today in Iraq and the Middle East, as world leaders gather for the annual G8 summit, which is being held this year on Sea Island off the coast of Georgia. The host, President Bush, will continue conversations begun over the weekend at World War II remembrances in Italy and France on the draft of a Security Council resolution to recognize the interim government in Baghdad and legitimize the presence of foreign troops in Iraq. The summit will also address the issue of democratic reform in the Middle East. That's a subject we'll focus on for much of this hour, with three guests who offer different views on the success of democratic reform taking root in the Middle East. Amid continued violence, the scandal at Abu Ghraib prison, and the evident decline of American moral and political authority, what's a realistic expectation for success? Are the democratic reforms that President Bush spoke of as recently as last week on the table in places like Riyadh, Cairo, Damascus, and Tehran? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Dana Milbank, White House reporter for The Washington Post. He's in Savannah, Georgia. He traveled to Europe with the presidential party. And Dana, thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Did the news of the death of President Reagan late Saturday afternoon here in Washington, I guess nighttime where the president and you were in France, how much of an effect did that have on the ceremonies on D-Day?
Well, it had a profound effect on the press corps and the coverage of the president's visit, in that everything immediately shifted to Ronald Reagan away from Iraq and D-Day. What was interesting is to actually be out there in Normandy on D-Day, and the president began his speech with a line praising and remembering President Reagan, which was to be expected. Mm-hmm. But what was really surprising to me was the extent to which D-Day was not overshadowed, at least there in Normandy, by the Reagan death. A lot of the old veterans there didn't even know, hadn't even seen the news of Reagan's death, because they had been traveling. A lot of our coverage, because the president dealt with it, the statement of Ronald Reagan the night before, and only had one line in his speech at the American Cemetery, allowed us, covering it, to focus on the 60th anniversary, the presence of the German chancellor at a D-Day ceremony for the first time. So it's been wall-to-wall coverage here in the United States, but actually being there in Normandy on the 60th anniversary of D-Day, it did not overshadow things.
Current day problems on the agenda at the G8 summit. Obviously, President Reagan's death will come up at the discussions. Several of the leaders coming for this summit may stay on in this country to attend the funeral here in Washington on Friday. They don't arrive down there until tonight. Is Ronald Reagan, with so much going on in the world today, so many issues and Iraq and the Middle East to dominate, this isn't likely to come up much in discussions, do you think?
Well, it'll certainly be the subject that will be discussed by the leaders in their private conversations, condolences offered. But the Bush administration has decided, really right from the start when they got the news in Paris on Saturday night, to carry through with the G8 as planned. The observance in the memorial in Washington is put off till Friday. So, and the White House said today that Vice President Cheney will be on hand to receive the body as it comes to Washington, but the president is expected to stay here in Georgia, where he's hosting this summit, so they can go about their business. And in the official White House briefings and pronouncements, it's been all about the Iraq UN resolution, about the Middle East Democracy Initiative, about the bilateral meetings the president's having, and really not about Reagan at all.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the Middle East Democracy Initiative. As drafts of that proposal are scaled back, revised, and leaked, I guess it's become something of a controversy today.
Well, it has a little bit, and an administration official who was giving one of the anonymous briefings here today expressed some irritation in the press that we seem to be dismissing this initiative. There are reasons that it has been dismissed, and that's because a lot of the Arab and Middle Eastern states did not have an interest in coming out here to essentially be seen as endorsing this plan, feeling that they were being used as props for this American initiative. But the White House is saying, well, stay tuned and see how we actually word this. It's going to be quite strong and quite useful. Obviously, it'll have a mixture of recommended economic, civil society, and political reforms. There's not a lot of optimism that this will suddenly lead to sweeping transformation towards democracy in the Middle East, but that's not stopping the White House from trying to launch that effort.
Last week in his speech, the president said that there would be a press for democratic reforms, and the United States would hold its friends to a higher standard. Two of its most important friends in the region, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, are not in attendance there at Sea Island.
Well, this is what gives rise to some of the skepticism, and there's been a long sort of back and forth in the administration's rhetoric, and the president has before spoken of the need for reforms in both Egypt and Saudi Arabia, but when it comes right down to it, he has the importance of the strategic importance of the alliance with those countries in the fight against terrorism has become primary to the democracy initiative. So they're trying to balance the two, but there's certainly a lot of skepticism that this is anything more than a public relations opportunity this week.
The proposal has been retitled and reframed somewhat to emphasize a political change coming from within individual countries rather than being imposed from outside. How much of a shift is that?
Well, I noticed that they're continuing to use the old wording as well, so that's probably just a simple packaging. But the theme, the idea is important. You can see also on Iraq this week, the administration is emphasizing that it's the new Iraqi interim government that is inviting American troops to remain, very much emphasizing that we are respecting the wishes of the local indigenous leaders. Now, whether that is true in the eyes of the Iraqi people remains to be seen in terms of how that government is accepted. But it's obviously the United States does not wish to be seen as imposing its view of democracy on the world, but rather leaving these countries free to pursue it themselves.
Dana Milbank, thanks very much.
Certainly, Neil.
Dana Milbank covers the White House for the Washington Post, and he spoke to us from Savannah, Georgia. The G8 summit gets underway just off the coast of Georgia on Sea Island later today. For the remainder of the hour, we're going to be discussing with several important and influential personalities the prospects for democracy in Iraq and throughout the Middle East and U.S. hopes for reform. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now from his office in New York is Fuad Ajami, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University, the author of several books on the politics and culture of the Middle East, including The Arab Predicament, Arab Political Thought and Practice since 1967. And Professor Ajami, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you for having me.
You've been a supporter of President Bush and the war in Iraq.
Yes.
In a recent op-ed article, though, you said that the dream is dead. Let's face it, Iraq is not going to be America's showcase in the Arab-Muslim world. What's happened?
I think you're absolutely right. I have been and remain a supporter of the war. That doesn't mean that you go out into the streets and cheer everything we've done. I think some of the greater hopes pinned on the war in Iraq may have been unrealistic. But I think we should take yes for an answer. We should take what we've done in Iraq. I've gone to Iraq twice since the fall of the despotism, and I retain great pride in our achievements in Iraq. If I even look at this interim cabinet and I look at its membership, when you consider that there are 16 Shia in this cabinet and 10 Sunnis and 8 Kurds, 1 Turkoman, 1 Christian, it's far more representative than any Arab government, than any of these governments that we've been allied with for a very long time. So I think we have our work cut out for us in Iraq, but we should be proud of what we have accomplished in that country. It's been a terribly hellish assignment, and that piece in the New York Times that you were kind enough to quote was almost torched, if you will, and by the pain one felt for the losses that our soldiers are enduring in Iraq, and that really was the spirit of the piece.
That the price has turned out to be much higher than anyone anticipated.
Absolutely.
On all sides.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has, you know, in a way, perhaps the early euphoria of the war, which we some of us felt then, was that early euphoria was dashed. We've ridden really a roller coaster of this war. The early panic that we would be hit by weapons of mass destruction, which haven't really materialized. The early sense of relief that it was easier than we thought. And then the steady hemorrhage over the last year behind us. And I think that really was the background of one's thinking about Iraq.
In those heady days, though, after the toppling of that statue of,
yes,
Saddam Hussein, you would have expected that come this G8 summit, there would have been a lot of attention to the U.S. proposals for reform in the Middle East. And instead, they seem to be falling a little flat.
Well, Neil, you yourself, when you were talking about the prospects for reform in the Arab world, and we are, when we take a look at the landscape there, two of the governments that we are closest to, and you've identified the two that really matter the most, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, because these were the home of the financiers, of the terrorists, of the operatives of Al-Qaeda, of the big top leaders, Ayman Zawahiri, this Egyptian aristocrat, and Osama bin Laden from Saudi Arabia. Those two are the most difficult. And when you take a look at the Arab landscape, the three largest Arab countries, in the Arab East, that is, Egypt, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, have been most passionate against this Greater Middle East initiative. Some of the smaller governments some of the smaller governments in the region are more reasonable. Bahrain, Yemen, Qatar, Kuwait, I mean, there are all kinds of winds of reform in the smaller countries. The problem remains. The problem is most acute in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, those two are our allies, and in Syria, which is not an allied government, of course.
Was it your sense that if events had gone better in post-war Iraq, Cairo and Riyadh would have been more responsive?
Well, I think you've asked a very fundamental question. I always thought that Iraq would either sustain what I call the Liberty Party in Arab life or the Tyranny Party in Arab life, that Arabs would take a look at Iraq and they would either draw courage for political reform or they would pull back and be frightened of the anarchy and be frightened of the violence. And we should take a look at some of our friends in the region. I mean, someone like Hosni Mubarak, who's on our payroll, he loves what's happening in Iraq because it's been his bet that Iraq would fail. So I think Iraq is really the test case, if you will, of this possibility of reform. Because Iraq, if Iraq were to change and turn for the better, this would be another government of 25 million people or so. This would be the alternative, if you will, to Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria, the other three, the three larger countries in the region. So everything hinges on Iraq. And the battle for Iraq is a broader battle for the Arab future.
We're speaking with Fuad Ajami, a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We'll continue our conversation when we come back. We'll also be speaking later in the program with Walter Russell Mead of the Council on Foreign Relations and with Ramzi Baroud, who's been doing a survey of Arab discussions on reform for Al Jazeera. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Back after a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing President Bush's goal of using a stable and democratic Iraq to spread political reform and democracy throughout the Middle East and diminished expectations given American setbacks in the region. You're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Fuad Ajami, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Just before the break, Professor Ajami, you were talking about the two extremes, the battle for tyranny or perhaps continued tyranny in the Middle East might be a better way to put it, or reform. What are the prospects that that tyranny can be dislodged at this point?
Well, that's the question, Neil, that generations of Arabs have been asking. They've been wondering, is there something exceptional about the Arabs? Is there something in the DNA, something in the blood, something in the tradition that has, in a way, left them outside the winds of change and outside this democratic wave that came into the world? And successive generations of Arab, and this generation in particular, is pressed and faced with this crisis. Now, the regimes in the saddle, they have the simple agenda. They wish to continue more of the same. They wish to function the way they've been functioning for decades. And I think that really is the resistance to any talk of reform. Tells you what the game is about. And instead of dealing with the issue of reform, they have dwelled on the sins of the messenger. Oh, the Americans can't bring us reform. Why can't they bring us reform? Because they're friends of Israel. The Americans can't bring us reform because of the crisis at Abu Ghraib and the prison scandal at Abu Ghraib. They are full of excuses and they are full of denials. And I think the time must come when they must face the crisis of the young and the crisis of economic and political retrogression. I mean, when you have the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who is said to be a leading reformer in the country, saying that the crisis of terrorism and the crisis of these religious extremists in Saudi Arabia is caused, 95% of it, he says, is caused by Zionists. It tells you that they're just reluctant to undertake the goal of the task of reform.
Let's bring a listener into the conversation. Peter joins us on the line from Berkeley, California.
Hi.
Hi.
On one of our public buildings in Washington, specifically at 10th Street in Pennsylvania, there's a marvelous quotation: "Justice in the life and conduct of the state is possible only as first it resides in the hearts and souls of the citizens."
Right.
And I think that reminds us that we really have to reach out to the entire population of a country, of a region of the world, in terms of educating and inspiring for democracy, and specifically for ethics. Ethics, we need leadership for a secular group of ethics that can transcend the different religious traditions while respecting them but not being dependent upon them. And I think this is critical. And when we get that and really take leadership, responsibility for that, we're really going to get places.
Do you see that in prospect, Professor Ajami?
Well, I think we have to just, I mean, I don't disagree with Peter. I think his sentiments are admirable. I think the problem here is when you take a look at the culture of the Arab world, unfortunately today, you have terrible rulers and worse oppositionists. And when you have these new websites, these Islamic quote-unquote websites that are spending enormous amount of time talking about the conditions under which infidels could be mutilated after the death, it tells you something about the decline of political culture and the decline of political order in these lands. They must renew the pact of modernity. They must find the dream of modernity once again. And that's why some of us who backed the war in Iraq hoped against hope, perhaps, that we need to go there. We need to find a place in the Arab world where we would have a go at this reform. Now, I grant you, in the end, no outsider can penetrate the inner core of a society. We can never penetrate the core of the educational system in Saudi Arabia. We can never penetrate the core of the Egyptian political decay and Egyptian authoritarianism. The Arabs must want the reforms for themselves. We can't want it for them more than they want it for themselves. That's the sad truth that stalks this Greater Middle East initiative of President Bush. Noble, but it is still an outsider's dream. And in my opinion, no foreign sword, however mighty, could cut the Gordian knot of this Arab decay and this Arab retrogression.
Peter, thanks very much for the question.
What's that other quotation? Under the rule of men entirely great, the the pen is mightier than the sword. And so, but it's that key, under the rule of men entirely great, we have to offer and set an example, and not give up hope to inspire rather than penetrate by force.
Now, Peter, thanks again. As we look ahead to this summit, there will be, I guess, a fine-sounding proposal that will emerge from this, given the fact that the two most important American allies in the Middle East will not be there, given the fact that this is not likely to have much of an effect. Is it counterproductive?
No, I can see why you asked the question, but I don't think it's counterproductive. It was very important for President Bush, and he's been doing it now for months, to say that for years and years, we have had this pact with authoritarianism in the region, in the Arab Muslim world. We were friends of dictatorship. And the president said it in a famous speech to the National Endowment for Democracy back in November, that we had accepted the pact with authoritarianism in the name of stability. But the pact did not work, because in the end, that pact was what gave us the terrors of September 11, 2001. So this Greater Middle East Initiative was an attempt to put us on the side of change and on the side of reform. But I grant you this, many people will be saying, if you really mean to stand by reform, why did the President of the United States host President Mubarak, this Egyptian despot, in Crawford, Texas, about a month or so ago? Why are we still footing the bill for the Egyptian despotism? So we will be called upon to make true and to come true on the kinds of things that we say.
Fuad Ajami, thanks, as always, for your time.
Thank you.
Fuad Ajami, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He was with us from his office in New York. And joining us now from our bureau in Chicago is Walter Russell Mead, a senior fellow in U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. His latest book is called Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. And good to have you back on the program.
It's great to be here.
You've been listening to Fuad Ajami speak about the prospects for democracy and how proud he is of what's been accomplished in Iraq, but how his ideas that perhaps this could be a beacon of democracy through the region seem to be fading. Do you agree with him?
Well, you know, I was a little less optimistic than Fuad and some of the other folks were at the beginning of this, and so maybe I'm a little less discouraged now. I kind of thought that if Iraq ended up looking a little bit like Turkey's ugly stepsister, that would be terrific progress, and I think we're well on track to achieving at least that and maybe something better.
And that would Turkey, a functioning but imperfect democracy, all democracies
are imperfect. Well, that's right, and Turkey, a country which is preparing to get into the European Union, has really begun to change its approach to its own Kurdish minority question, where there's real competition among political parties, but is a state where the overwhelming majority of the population are Muslim by religion.
But what about outside of Iraq? I know you just returned from a trip to the region, visiting several countries there. What about what we heard from Professor Ajami talking about? Is there desire in the hearts of the people there for democratic reform?
There's good news and bad news, I think. In Jordan, I was impressed, and actually also in Algeria, where they are emerging out of this terrible civil war and have held free the flawed elections that resulted in a re-election of the sitting president with a suspiciously large majority, but not a 99% majority. People do seem to want more openness. In Egypt, I heard there was a lot of talk about the Declaration of Alexandria by a group of Egyptian intellectuals who are really calling on Arab governments to reform. So there is real urge for change and growth, but there are a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another listener involved in the conversation. Mohammed joins us from Bloomfield, Michigan.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I think change in the Middle East has to come from within. I mean, we've got to remember, it's not just the Arabs that don't want to change. Also, the Europeans, they have a stake of a Middle East not controlled by us entirely as Americans. So, but I think you got to get the younger generation, enlist them in the armies of these countries, and let them lead the revolution from inside. because each time somebody rises up, the government sends the army and they quiet them down. So you got to have this change come to that. And the armies of these countries are the most powerful tools that these leaders use. So you got to...
Mohammed, your cell phone is betraying you, but thanks very much for the question. Did you hear that, Walter Russell-Mead?
Yeah, I did. And again, I think Mohammed has a good point there. If you look at the Turkish example, the army was a major force for modernization. Now, then there comes a point where the army isn't maybe willing to give up enough power to civilian leaders, and then you have another stage of the struggle. But modernization in some countries can be led by relatively authoritarian forces as long as they're competent and honest. So I think the key here, though, throughout the Middle East, is it is a real illusion to think that there's some switch you can flip that would turn darkness to light, that this is going to be a long, drawn-out process. The leadership will have to come from within. But encouragement and help can come from without as well.
Encouragement, though, as Professor Ajami says, some of the leaders in the Middle East look at Iraq and say, see what happens. We need to keep things the way they are.
Well, let's wait and see how things go in Iraq. Again, things could go, you know, from where we are and sit now in Iraq, we could see. I mean, today we've just heard that 9 political parties have agreed to give up their militias. It's possible this election process will take hold. So, you know, Iraq could go in one direction. This is very, very early in the process of change.
So while it was far too early to declare success after the fall of Baghdad, maybe it's too early to declare a failure.
That would we haven't finished failing yet anyway, even in the worst case. I think there's still some chance for an upturn.
Let's get another caller in. Anne is with us from Hubbardston, Massachusetts.
Hi.
My
question is about capitalism, and it seems to me that in the media, starting a democracy in Iraq has also included the beginnings of capitalism, and I'm wondering if that's really going to help the democracy along, or if it's maybe making it more difficult.
That, Anne, is an excellent question, and actually in my latest book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, I talk a lot about the very complicated relationship between capitalism, stability, and democracy, because in some ways capitalism is a very revolutionary social system, and especially the new kind of capitalism that we've been promoting in the last 30 years, much more deregulated, much more global, much more aggressive. And definitely capitalism upsets traditional social structures. It accelerates the movement of people from the land to the city. It causes a lot of disturbances. But A, it's inevitable in the world that we live in today that a developing country like Iraq is going to be part of the capitalist system. B, what Iraq had before, let's not forget, wasn't some kind of idyllic hunter-gatherer or other kind of Eden existence. It was a very, very corrupt state capitalism mixed with some sort of evil remnants of feudalism, I suppose, in the sense of a loyalty to the leader shaping everything. And so you had the combination of corruption, complete insecurity in people's property, and then a kind of a blanket of authoritarianism that made it impossible for ordinary people to use the system to work for them. So I think that some of the original ideas that these kind of wild-eyed ideologues came into Iraq with, and we were going to make it the most free market country in the world and so on, were so far removed from reality that they were hopelessly unrealistic. And in fact, what we've seen is most of these have just kind of quietly withered and died on the vine. But getting an Iraqi government that allows the Iraqi people to make small businesses, build their own homes, and other ways lay the foundation for mass prosperity and freedom is really very important.
Anne, thank you.
Thank you.
We're speaking about democratic reform in the Middle East. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Does the United States, Walter Russell-Mead, have the moral authority in the region anymore to be the messenger of this, the apostle of democratic and indeed economic reform?
No. And I don't think actually we've had it for a long time. I don't think we lost it in Iraq. The association of the U.S. with Israel in a lot of people's minds has poisoned it. Also, you have to understand that through their very much state-controlled and limited media, they've gotten a very distorted picture of us. I mean, over and over again, when I talk to people ranging from fairly senior diplomats to groups of high school students and college students, their description of the American system was not that we are a democracy at all. If you ask them, what is America's government, they'd say, the Jews run America. I mean, it's really that simple. Somebody once described the intellectual atmosphere of the Middle East as Noam Chomsky meets the elders of Zion. And you have a lot of people who literally believe that the best guide to understand the American polity is to read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So we are very far from being a kind of a trustworthy source for a lot of people in that region for anything.
Walter Russell Mead, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Walter Russell Mead, a senior fellow in U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. And he was with us from our bureau in Chicago. To get some idea of what Arab intellectuals are discussing at the moment, we go now to Doha, Qatar, where Ramzi Bahrud joins us on the line. He's at the phone on his office. He's the head of research and special projects at AlJazeera.net English. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
You've conducted research for a special report that appeared on the Al Jazeera English website last month. Your researchers did interviews with a variety of people, including people on the street, to find out what they think about democratic reform. We just have about a minute left in this segment, but tell us what you found.
Well, as far as the people on the street is concerned, there was a dilemma in the mind of most of the people whom we spoke with. And the dilemma is that they trust the message and they strongly support the fact that Arabs and they are in need of serious reforms, democratic, social, cultural, etc. However, they do not trust the messenger. In fact, they do believe that the United States government and foreign policy is the core problem in the first place. Therefore, they are caught between their belief of the need for reform and on the other hand, of the fact that they neither trust their governments because they believe they are corrupt, rightly so, and at the same time, they do not trust the United States, who has been using many of the Arab governments, the friendly regimes, or the so-called the friendly regimes in the region, as client states to serve its economic and strategic interests in the region. And because of that, there is a serious dilemma, in which not only the average Arab is falling into, but the Arab intellectual as well.
And we'll have more questions with you about that when we come back from a short break. I hope you can stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In just a few minutes, we'll be discussing some of the lessons of the battle for Fallujah with journalist Robert Kaplan at the Atlantic Monthly. But now let's continue our conversation with Ramzi Bahrud, who's the director of research and studies at AlJazeera.net English. He's joining us from his office in Doha, Qatar. And just before the break, you were talking about how your survey talked to people the man on the street, if you will, who was suspicious of governments he regarded as corrupt and suspicious of the United States as the apostle of democracy. You were about to tell us some of the conversations that are underway amongst intellectuals in the Arab world.
Well, Arab intellectuals, as obvious from media commentary of leading authors in various Arab countries, equally and strongly distrust the U.S. motive in the so-called Greater Middle East, the most revised initiative, arguing that the U.S. is only seeking interests in the region by turning all Arab countries perhaps to model client states without expecting to address or redress the region's grievances, such as the grinding and very costly Arab-Israeli conflict. So basically, the understanding is that the U.S. Is attempting to reshape the Arab world in a way that would fit its interest, be it strategic, political, economic, etc., without really addressing the region's real and serious concerns, the actual issues of the human rights in various Arab countries, and the Arab-Israeli conflict, and of course the quagmire developing in Iraq today. This is the understanding, but on the other hand, there is a stronger, or let's say equal, emphasis on the fact that reforms are overdue in the Arab world, and they are needed, and they are and that need is compelling. And but the question, yes.
I was just going to ask, are those reforms seen in democratic terms? Is democracy seen as something that could legitimize a new kind of government in the Middle East?
Well, of course. The greater emphasis is on political reforms, because there is a belief that political reforms is the gate to other kind of reforms. There are various interpretations of what reform is, of course, and how to bring about freedom and democracy to a region that has been suffering from immense political stagnation for decades. However, there is a near complete agreement that genuine reform must come from within the Arab world without outside pressure, and that the U.S. government is, unfortunately, the least qualified force to be trusted in such an endeavor, considering the unprecedented lack of trust that the U.S. formed in the Middle East as a result, among other reasons, of the ongoing quagmire in Iraq and Washington's decades-long support of the State of Israel on the expense of Palestinians and other Arab nations.
Let's get a caller in. Lisa joins us from Brisbane, California.
Hello. I'm going to read my question because I'm too nervous.
Okay, go ahead.
Here it is. How do you expect the culture in the Middle East to have successful democracy in Iraq or anywhere else when they fundamentally don't believe in equality? And we're talking men, women, tribe, rich, poor. You know, I have friends in Egypt that can't go out to dinner because they're women, you know, and I just wonder, are we going to be able to have women vote? Are we going to have tribes repressing tribes from voting? I mean, how is democracy going to work in that kind of a culture?
Ramzi Bahrud, I know we've been having dropouts on your line. Were you able to hear the question?
I was able to hear it, and I appreciate it very much. There are two things I would like to say about this. First, there is almost a consensus among many Arabs, and they are openly debating this, and thanks to television stations like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya that such voices are being heard, is that, yes, we do have some serious problems and social problems, and yes, women rights are being compromised in the Arab world, and the human rights in general are being compromised. However, the fact that we would use this realization as an attempt to halt even the prospect of achieving reforms in the Middle East is wrong, for the simple reason that worse inequality swept through Europe and the United States, the advanced first world, for not decades, but for hundreds of years. And yet, somehow, they managed to prevail, and they managed to adopt a democracy that catered to the need of the people. And I would say that they have reached, you know, a tremendous success in this regard. I think Arabs are equally qualified to reach that stage, considering the fact that Islam is in fact capable of reviving, not necessarily itself, but the culture of which it was trusted, and reach out to the outside world and be able to sponsor a genuine and lasting democracy.
Lisa, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Ramzi Bahrud, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Ramzi Bahrud, head of research and studies at AlJazeera.net English, and he spoke to us from his office in Doha, Qatar.